Good afternoon, fellow patriots in Eastern Washington. This is Matt Shea broadcasting from the front lines in the battle for freedom and liberty, Olympia, Washington. As always, brought to you by the committee to elect Matt Shea Republican and the legacy of Dr. Stan Monteith, bringing you the story behind the story and the news behind the news. It's not about right or left. It's about right and wrong, about our hope not being in man, but in Jesus Christ, about not ending in prayer, but moving to action and remembering the difference between the gospel of salvation and the gospel of the kingdom. We are admonished by Christ to go out and preach the gospel and make disciples beyond the four walls of the church. As Jeremiah 17, 7 through 8 says, "Blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord and whose trust is the Lord, for he will be like a tree planted by the water that extended its roots by a stream and with no fear when the heat comes. Its leaves will be green and it will not be anxious in a year of drought, nor cease to yield fruit." That's the admonishment. We should have no fear. We should be bold and courageous as lions, especially on the more difficult issues of the day that nobody wants to talk about or that get you labeled. They may get you labeled domestic terrorist. They may get you labeled Islamophobic and whatever words they're going to try to make up in the future, but we still need to stand. The Constitution means what it says. The Bible means what it says. And broadcasting throughout all of Eastern Washington, Northern Idaho, and Northeast Oregon, you folks listening to this know that. We need to be involved. Our area of the country is becoming a front line. It is becoming an experiment where they're trying everything they can to push the boundaries of tyranny, to push the boundaries of Marxism, to push the boundaries of Islam. And we need to stand against it. So with that, I am going to bring my guest on first today, somebody that has been fighting for a very, very long time against what's been happening in our country. And we're going to be talking about a wide range of issues. But Phil Haney is a founding member of the Department of Homeland Security. He's a counterterrorism specialist and also the author of See Something, Say Nothing. Phil, thanks very much for joining me on Patriot Radio today. How are you doing?
Very well. I really loved your statement about not having fear, because that's really essential. We should be able to stand in the middle of the fight without fear if we're fully equipped and armed with the armor of God, because all weapons or no weapons formed against us can prosper. I know that's true. I've seen it. I know it's true.
It is, and really, in a lot of areas that I've seen in government, it's holding people back. They're afraid to lose their job. They're afraid that their reputation is going to be assailed. They're afraid that, you know, somebody just might make fun of them. I mean, on social media, which really doesn't mean much of anything. If you could,
that's an important point to make, because fear makes us compromise from what we know is right. And most of the reason why people in positions of authority don't do what they know in their heart is right, it's a fear, and it's usually a fear of a loss of something. Fear. You're right.
And God tells us not to hold on to the things of this world. And, you know, it's His reputation. It's His message. At least it's supposed to be. And if we really believe that, why are we afraid?
We shouldn't be afraid at all if we know who the author and finisher of our faith is. And then you really find out what you believe when you're put into the lion's den, or into the fiery furnace, or you start taking incoming fire. And of course, I mostly mean that allegorically. But you know, the shock of battle, even in spiritual warfare, is just as intense as the shock of kind of warfare we think of with guns and bombs. There's real shock that comes to it. And we're not immune to injury either, but the Lord will sustain us. But just recognizing that also is important, because He is there. And we do suffer loss of a different kind when we go into these battles. That's why I said count costs. Make sure you know what you're getting into. Don't just wander out into the middle of the battlefield without being aware.
Well, a lot of the things that we're going to talk about today didn't start in the Obama administration, but they really kind of grew during the Obama administration to a point where it's affecting the security of the United States of America. And there's been a lot talked about in the media by a lot of people that probably don't know anything about what they're talking about. But let's talk a little bit first about Pakistan, talk about what's happening there and also in, obviously, Afghanistan, in Iran. Can you tell the listeners what's happening in that part of the world, what's really happening, and what we should be paying attention to?
Okay, we've all heard of Al-Qaeda 1,000 times since 9/11, right? We know of the terrorists called Al-Qaeda, right? And we hear that, we think of Osama bin Laden. Is that correct? If you hear Al-Qaeda, you think of Osama bin Laden, right?
Right.
Generally? Okay. Did you know that the original Al-Qaeda is not called Al-Qaeda? It's called the Global Jihad Front. They never called themselves Al-Qaeda. We did. The reason why is Al-Qaeda is not an organization. It's a concept. It means the base, like the base of operations. You might say like the Republican base or the Democratic base. It's a concept. It's not a group particularly. So this thing called the base, we call the Al-Qaeda, was actually called Global Jihad Front. It was a coalition. It wasn't just one group of people following Osama bin Laden around. There were five original founders of this global coalition called the Islamic or the Global Jihad Front. And there were 14 organizations. Half of the 14 organizations which were in the original Al-Qaeda were from the Indian subcontinent. Groups like Tablighi-Jamaat, which I've talked to about before, regarding San Bernardino, or Lashkar-e-Taiba, who did the Mumbai massacre, or Tauhid-Jamaat, who did the Colombo Sri Lanka bombings. They're all part of a branch of Islam that originates in the Indian subcontinent known as the Deobandi, because of a city in India called Deoband, India. So they're called by the city where this movement started. They're Salafi Sunni Muslims, or pro-jihad, allied with people like Saudi Arabia. And they have tens of thousands of madrasas all across the Indian subcontinent. You're talking in Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, and Myanmar. It's the largest coalition, the largest branch of Islam in the entire world. They don't speak Arabic. They speak Pashto Urdu. So you have Salafi jihadis from the Near East that speak Arabic. Those are the ones that we know about. Those are the ISISs and the Hamases, even the Hezbollahs. They all speak Arabic. These groups speak Pashto Urdu. The largest, most well-known group of this large coalition is known as the Taliban. The Taliban, in the language, means students, plural. They're students of what? The Deobandi branch of Islam. They formed half of the original coalition of what we know of as Al-Qaeda. But we never hear about them, do we?
Almost never. Literally, that's the first time I've actually even heard that name.
Now, why is that, friend? This is not meant to be a criticism, just an observation. How come we don't know that?
Well, I think that the media...
20 years down 9/11.
Yeah. Well, I think the media is...
20 years after 9/11.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, you're right. It's partly media. It's partly the narrative. You remember those hearings before House and Senate Intel committees or judiciaries or Homeland Security, where you would hear officials just say over and over like a broken record, we're fighting Al-Qaeda, or we're fighting the evil ideology of ISIS, right? They would just say that over and over again, while never mentioning that the true nature of this coalition that we call Al-Qaeda was actually already global in extent, and that a major portion of the organizations that were part of that original coalition that started about 1998 were from the Indian subcontinent. And the point is that they've reformed, and now they call themselves Al-Qaeda of the Indian subcontinent, AQIS. And they have published a 20-page code of conduct, which is a synonym for Sharia, how to wage war according to Sharia law. And I almost hate to ask you, but would you like to know what their primary strategy is?
I would love to know it, and so would the listeners.
to target Israelis and Americans anywhere in the world. Now, WHO has also been saying that a lot lately, actually for the last 40 years. Another large branch of Islam or originating in a country called Iran. Both of them have been saying the same thing for a long time. Now, where is old Iran located geographically? Right on the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan. It's a tri-border area. And where do you suppose these people from the Indian subcontinent, Taliban-like people, are funneling, going east and going west, right through southeast Iran? Now, who is in charge of all that operation? A guy named Qasem Soleimani. You've heard of him, right?
I've heard of him for years, but most people have just recently heard of him, and I think that this is the important point. Who was he really? How long has he been doing this?
Well, he's been a right-hand man of the regime for, well, I think he came up through IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, from his youth. And he's been running. He is the leader of, he's the hub that the wheel spins on of the Quds Force, which is a subgroup of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, which was designated as a global terrorist organization by President Trump on April 8th of last year. So the question then becomes, if these individuals and organizations have already been designated as global terrorists, then the question is, what do you do with a globally designated terrorist? Have dialogue and outreach and negotiations with them, which was what the previous administration did, or you just basically take direct action? Well, President Trump took direct action. Not only was Qasem Soleimani running operations that we hear about more in the West, he was also liaisoning and entering operations originating from the Indian subcontinent that we hear, again, to make the point, never hear anything about. And yet, they're half, at least, of the entire global coalition of the global Islamic movement, and they come from the Indian subcontinent.
Well, there's a couple of questions I think that come out of that. And the first that I want to focus on, actually, there's three questions. The first that I want to focus on is, what did Soleimani, what did he actually do in America? Was he in charge of establishing terror cells in America? Was he in charge of funneling weapons? Or was he really, truly the peacemaker that some in the media are trying to make him out to be?
Most of the Iranian activity, Hezbollah, IRGC, Quds Force people, comes out of the tri-border area in South America. There's another big nexus of activity in the Panama Free Trade Zone, because that has traditionally been run by immigrant businessmen from, of all places, Lebanon, in Panama. And another strong nexus is Venezuela. The largest mosque in the southern hemisphere, western southern hemisphere, is in Caracas, Venezuela. It's called the Al-Ibrahimi Mosque. And so here you have these major points of contact, the tri-border area, Paraguay, Brazil, I forget which the other one, three countries. And then you've got the Panama Free Trade Zone, which is money laundering. And then you've got the, you know, kind of the thug component, through Venezuela. And they were all funneling up through Central America and hit our border, crashed into our border like a gigantic wave. Guess who shut the case down that we call Project Cassandra, that was trying to stop all of that rising tide of drug trafficking, human trafficking, weapons trafficking, counterfeit passports, terrorism, and a lot of other things, unpleasant things on the list. President Obama. It was called Project Cassandra. You can look it up. It was shut down in the year 2012, It so happens that I was working at the National Targeting Center at the time, which is outside Washington, D.C., in a unit called the Advanced Targeting Team, ATT. I was working on the Tablighi-Jamaat initiative, which is a global-level case related to those Deobandi groups that I was talking to you about earlier. My colleague, who literally sat right next to me, and we talked virtually every day, casually, about it, was running the Project Cassandra case, trying to stop the flow of terrorism and drugs and weapons up through Central America into the southern border. And they shut his case and my case down in the summer of 2012. What was... And put us in peril. I call it unnecessary risk. I also call it national security meltdown. And that's what we've seen. The fact that we don't know these things that we ought to is a national security meltdown in itself. Because if more people knew and really knew and understand it, I think more people would say something about it. But like in the title of my book, See Something, Say Nothing, people don't really actually realize what they're looking at. And if they do actually manage to recognize what they're really looking at, then they're afraid to say anything, like what you said in your opening. So now we've come all the way back to where you started the opening of your program and proved the same point you made, that you see something, you have to say something. But in order to do it, you have to be prepared, you know, like the Bible says, redeem the time. And it, as Acts 17, God once winked at this ignorance, but now commands men everywhere to repent. We're not authorized, according to the Bible, to schlep our way through life in a state of blissful unawareness. We have the Holy Spirit so we can see what's going on around us and then help ourselves and our friends and neighbors begin to prepare for it.
What was the reason that the Obama administration gave for you guys to close the cases down? I mean, was there any reason given, or was just here, this is an order, follow it?
No, they used one of those wonderful euphemisms. We're going to go in a different direction. Without ever really explaining what that new direction was, they just, it's one of the classic inside the Beltway DC euphemisms. We're going to go in a different direction. But that actually wasn't enough for them to simply shut the case down. You could almost say that was passive. Then they decided they had to delete all the information out of the classified law enforcement database. Because we certainly can't have residues of that information hanging around, reminding us down the road, 3, 5, 10 years down the road, that, oops, actually, we did know about those people or we did know about those groups. But that even wasn't enough. Then they took the third step. They went after the people that put the information in the system in the first place to discredit them and ruin their career so that no one would ever believe them, me. I was one of them. They came after me. They tried to put me in jail. They convened a grand jury, the same kind of grand jury we've been hearing about more lately, which actually wasn't a grand jury, and they convened it to find probable cause to indict me on criminal charges to put me in jail. For what? Violating the civil rights and civil liberties and or the privacy rights of foreign nationals by saying or implying that they might be part of a terrorist group and therefore violating their civil rights. That's really what they did.
You know, this is incredible. A lot of people don't even, they're not even going to almost believe that this happened, that the guy that was at the very tip of the spear fighting terrorism in the world and these terrorist organizations, to be more appropriate, ends up almost being called the terrorist himself. That is unbelievable. And if you could quickly, because I've heard this not just from you, Phil, I've heard this from other sources, that the Obama administration was ordering them to destroy records across the board. How do you prove something like that if the record doesn't exist anymore?
Great question. You hold your breath. You're ready for me to answer you?
Yes.
I kept them.
And that's why you're not in jail today.
That's exactly why I'm not in jail today. not only did I keep them, I gave them to the one body in our structure of our government that has the authority to keep them, Congress. I not only kept the records. You know, when we're in kindergarten, we're taught look both ways before you cross the street, right? So something bad might happen to you if you forget to look both ways. That's still true, right?
Yeah, I think
so. They forgot to look both ways when they deleted the records, because apparently they didn't know the system as well as they thought, which they didn't. They were just pressing F2, F4, control, all delete function keys as fast as they could push them to delete the records out of the system because someone told them up the chain of command to do it. They saluted, yes, sir, will do, sir. Go sit down at the console. The first crime they committed is they used my own social security number to access the records. That was a legal violation right there.
So they were trying to make it look like, just a second, I want to highlight that. They were trying to make it look like you were deleting the records.
Yeah, the only way they could access the records is through my social security number. Because in federal government, that was our ID when we entered the system, was our own social security number. So they begin to sit down and do the literally tapping on the keyboard, and they forgot something. Down in the right-hand corner of these screens, that these records, how they appear on the computer screen, which is like a template, like a PDF form, down in the very bottom right-hand corner, there's a little tiny space, and it has the option for a 1 or a 0. If you put a 0, nothing happens when somebody looks at your record. If you put a little 1 over there, you get a copy in your email every single time anybody ever looks at their record. It's designed to keep you in touch with your colleagues in law enforcement that might be working on an aspect of the case out in L.A. or down in Miami or up in Chicago. You know somebody's looking at your record, and maybe they might have a question. They want to ask you, Officer Haney, why did you put this record on in this guy and anything you need to know? We've got him in our secondary. We're talking to him right now. What would you like to know about him? Well, I ask him what city he was born in. Ask him if he has any other passports. Ask him what his father's name is. Stuff like that. Okay, we'll do it. Then I'd get the information back, and I'd upgrade the record. I'd add that new little tidbit. Those, my friend, are called dots. Dots. Connecting the dots. Those are the dots. So what the Obama administration did is went in and obliterated the dots. But they forgot that when they accessed the records, every time they did anything with them, I would get an email. So I started getting stacks and stacks of email in my email box. And what do you suppose I did with them? I didn't delete them like Hillary Clinton. I kept them. I know the second. I mean the literal second when they were deleted. Not to mention the minute and the hour and the day and the month and the year. And I also know who deleted them. Because their name was in it. They're the user on the system, even though they accessed it illegally and used my social. Their name is still tagged to the record. They're the one that's on it. I have it.
So how come those people haven't been at least investigated or interviewed or prosecuted for doing this?
They've been promoted.
And they're still there today, I presume.
Yes. Every single person involved in, for example, deletion of the records that led directly to the San Bernardino shooting is still active duty.
That is incredible.
That's what you call the swamp, my friend. You're looking at the swamp. This is the swamp.
Well, and I hope everybody listening understands how, if that's the case, and this isn't, some administrative position way back, tucked in some small office somewhere that really doesn't, work on anything that matters. I mean, these are the folks that are supposed to be protecting our homeland. that intentionally erased records.
This case had 1,200 law enforcement actions taken on it in 7 months. When I say law enforcement actions, what I mean is deportations, refusals of entries, cancellations of visas, those kind of things on 1,200 different people in 7 months. That's what Obama destroyed. He not only deleted the records out of the system, he destroyed our capacity to stop those kind of people from coming in anymore. They have been coming in ever since. That was the summer of 2012. How long ago is that? Eight and a half years ago? Seven and a half, whichever. Wow. It's been going on now like a broken water pipe out in the middle of the street, downtown Seattle, for the last 8.5 years, or 7.5.
Well, I want to shift.
Because he destroyed the case. Yep.
Well, I want to shift gears back to what we were talking about as far as Iran is concerned, because, and then we can talk about the infiltration in America. I think we need to come back to that, but I really want to go back to Iran, because I've read in the media that they were claiming that Soleimani was actually in Iraq for a peace mission, that he was actually there to, you know, negotiate peace, and that he was, you know, this kind of peacemaker. And I've been following him for years. I've studied that area of the world. I served over in Iraq. I knew who that guy was long before most Americans did, as you. If you could describe what you think was happening in Iraq with Soleimani, what he was actually doing there, talking to a militia leader, an Iraqi militia leader.
Well, yeah, that would be the first question. Peace with who? What's really going on the ground is, you ever heard of a guy named Muqtadar Sadr, S-A-D-R?
Yes, I have.
He leads the Mujahideen 10,000 plus army out of Basra, out of southern Iraq. He's Iranian. Then you've got these other commanders in different portions of this country or the region of Iraq. There's four languages: Farsi, Turkish, Kurdish, and Arabic. And there are about 75 different ethnic groups within the confines of what we know of as Iraq. And they don't all get along. The smaller the tribe is, the more violent they are, because they're protecting their territory. And if you touch your toe on their line, they will come after you. You talk about tribalism. There are 75 different tribes operating. And then they have their own loyalties. And plus, they speak their own language and dialogue, for that matter. And then you have the Iranians coming in on top of it all, superimposing their authority over the top of an already volatile ethnic and political situation. That's what he was trying to get peace with. Sadr is exerting his influence in the south, and you have these other militia commanders that are getting bent out of shape because their influence is being diminished, especially with the animosities that exist between the Iraq-Iran war, which is in the late 80s. There's a lot of undercurrents there between themselves and between themselves and Iran. That's what Qasem Soleimani was there for.
So the media also tries to conflate Shia Islam and Sunni Islam, or tries to make it divided depending on what their narrative is for the day. And the prevailing narrative, though, is that it's divided. Sunnis and Shia never work together. They never talk. If you could address that issue as well, because you mentioned about the transit across southern Iran.
Well, the most obvious example of Shia and Sunni working together is the now revealed global alliance between the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, and the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood is the largest Sunni Salafi, meaning original, not radical, but Salafi, going back to the original form of Islam, the largest Sunni Islamic organization in the world is the Muslim Brotherhood. they're saturated into this social structure of probably 60 to 80 countries around the world, including ours. They have allied formally with the IRGC. And so they're already saturated into the systems like water and sponge. So what they do is they work cooperatively. The MV works on the ground at the local level, the city level, state level, national level. And they liaison with Iran. They work together hand in glove. Now, that's all come out in the last few months. Not only do they work together, they're as close as a hand in a glove on a global level. And then you add that other component of the force of gravity coming in from the Indian subcontinent. A lot of those organizations have a fundamental foundation of ideology, theology of Islam that is synonymous with the Muslim Brotherhood. And so actually you have a sphere of influence that reaches all the way to the Pacific Ocean on the Asian side. So now you got the whole globe covered.
And this idea that Sunnis and Shia don't work together, I mean, really blown out of the water throughout the ages. They will work against a common enemy, and then they'll fight it out afterwards if there's still an argument about who's in control. And I think people don't understand that the common bond is Sharia law between them. And can you discuss that
That's
briefly?
Right. That's their strategy. The strategy of the global Islamic movement is not the fight jihad. That's a tactic. And I know you understand the difference between strategy and tactic. But I know you also know if you don't understand the difference between strategy and tactic, it's a fatal error. Because if you get them mixed up, you're shooting into the dark. The strategy of the global Islamic movement is implementation of Sharia law. That's it. It's very simple. It's not complicated. What is complicated and kaleidoscopic about it are the tactics that you use to accomplish that goal. And that's where the Muslim Brotherhood are extraordinary. They are adaptable. They change shape like water in a glass. Every country is like a different shaped glass. And they can take the shape of the glass. They fit right in with it. And they use it to saturate through the cult of society of structure. And gradually, like the Taliban says, you have the watches, we have the time. They have the watches. We have the watches. They have the time. And they saturate into the structure and gradually over time through the schools, through the government, through every agency, through the political arena, like Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, they begin to saturate into a culture and gradually implement provisions of Sharia. Whatever they can push in, they'll push it in. And that's how they do it. In every single country. And if there's a mosque like in Dearborn that happens to be Shia Iranian origin, they're also interested in implementation of Sharia too. So they can work together. And you're right though, it's like a soccer game and the ball's in the middle of the field. Both teams are going to run at the ball and try to get it. The thing about it is they have to play the game according to the rules. Otherwise they're disqualified, like the Super Bowl coming up. If the 49ers don't play according to the rules, they'll be disqualified, and the other team will win. So they play according to the rules. And what are the rules? Sharia. But they have different color uniforms. They have their own fan base. They have their own stadiums and everything, a whole management. Every team has its entire infrastructure, but they all play according to the same rules. And that's how it is with Sunni and Shia.
So let's shift back to the infiltration into the United States. A lot has been talked about in regards to the Muslim Brotherhood infiltrating the United States of America. Very little, however, has been talked about the Iranian infiltration into the United States of America through various organizations. If you could talk a little bit about what's real and what's not real and what's put in the media, but what the facts are on the ground.
Good place to start is Dearborn, Michigan. There's a large mosque there. It's easy to find. You can look it up online. And you'll notice that they had a joint press conference after Soleimani was targeted. And guess who was there with them? CAIR, Council on American Islamic Relations. Well, that's a Sunni organization, a front group for the Muslim Brotherhood. But there they were standing shoulder to shoulder in solidarity about their opinion and their feelings about the taking out of Soleimani. Of course, they did not support it. But this guy, the imam of that mosque, has direct ties all the way back to Iran. And all we really need to do, it's not, you don't have to reinterpret what they say, or you don't even really need classified information. Just go sit and listen to what he says every Friday. They tell you exactly what they think. But that's another thing that Obama did, is he made it impossible for law enforcement officers to develop cases to the point of probable cause. He wouldn't allow us to develop the evidence that we needed to make a probable cause case. He said, essentially, that they have to come and hand you the information that will give you the probable cause, but you can't ask them anything that would allow you to establish probable cause. So he made it impossible. He destroyed the capacity of law enforcement to develop cases because we weren't allowed to ask the questions, the smaller level questions, that would allow us to develop a solid watertight case. And Detroit, Iran, strong connection. I think it's the strongest Shia community in the whole United States. It starts way back during Henry Ford's time. He brought Muslims in from the Middle East to work in the factories. And so that's why it's the oldest Muslim community in the entire United States. It goes back more about 100 years. So, yeah, that would be a good place to start right there.
So are there Iranian-backed terror cells in the United States of America that are already operating here? What can people look for? I mean, we can talk a little bit about the Muslim Brotherhood, which most people are familiar with it because we brought it up on the show before. But what are the Iranians doing here in America as far as that is concerned? And are there sleeper cells that they could activate, you know, in a case like, you know, we were almost in here a couple of weeks ago?
Well, rather than Iranians, or I should say along with Iranians, the most likely country of origin for the Shia branch of Islam is going to be Lebanon. And or maybe some from Yemen, but the most distinctive one or clear one is Lebanese. Because, as I mentioned, they run the Panama Free Trade Zone. They're good businessmen. They've been doing it for thousands of years. They have hawala networks. Hawala is an Arabic word for basically money transferring. They have an entire infrastructure that allows them to collect money from individuals and mosques and other sources of revenue, charity donations, and funnel it through these essentially underground hawala networks, going back to the point of origin, some bank in Tehran or some bank in Beirut, Lebanon. And it's a portal. You pour the money down a hole, it pops out on the other side of the world. Suddenly you're in Lebanon, in the lobby of an Islamic bank in downtown Beirut. So the Lebanese have been running smuggling operations in the United States for a long time. That's where we go back to Project Cassandra. If people want to get a nutshell version of the depth and breadth of the network, just go back and look up Project Cassandra and do a little bit of reading, because it was a very precisely targeted operation. The reason why it's easier to look at it from a big perspective is because it's a smaller community. It's not as widespread. So you have the same dynamics, the same structure, but it's more concentrated. So it makes it easier for you to see the trends when you look at these more concentrated communities, like the one in Dearborn or other parts. And they move free too. They're pretty mobile in their operations. But they were doing infamil, that's infant formula, cigarettes, other kinds of merchandise, crossing borders and reselling them in other states where there's no state tax or sales tax and making a lot of extra money off of it. And then they were buying cars from used car lots around the country and shipping these cars over to Lebanon and other places, even West Africa, and making very high profit off of each one of those, what we would call kind of a semi-junky car. Well, they buy them and they send them overseas and they're worth 3 or 4 or 5 times what they're worth here. So it was a gold mine for them. And that was what they were doing on the ground in America. What they were doing in Venezuela or in the tri-border or in the Panama Free Trade Zone were different activities. But it was all about, and then they hooked up with the bandidos in Mexico with the drug cartels and started funneling money that they were making off the drug trade on behalf of the drug cartels, because they're really good at laundering money. So it's a perfect arrangement. You guys on the cartels, you move merchandise, we'll cover the money for you. And that's what they've done. Formed a coalition.
So, Phil, back to the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States. There has been a vast infiltration. The Holy Land Foundation trial had a list of unindicted co-conspirators, and to my knowledge, none of those unindicted co-conspirators have been prosecuted to this day. What will it take for that to happen? If you could also talk about the extent of the infiltration in the United States, and you know, what's stopping the Trump administration from declaring the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist organization?
Good point. Good question. Remember I mentioned earlier about IRGC and the Muslim Brotherhood?
Yes.
Their alliance? If the IRGC has been officially, as of April 8, 2019, designated as a global terrorist organization, and the Muslim Brotherhood is affiliated with it, and we know that, then in the good old days of law enforcement, we could say that by default, by association, you're allied with the globally designated terrorist group. I think that's what we call a clue in law enforcement. Therefore, by default, you also should be designated as a global terrorist organization. We've actually transcended Holy Land. We're actually past that in terms of a reason for designating the Muslim Brotherhood. They're allied with Iran, with the IRGC. That in itself should be more than enough. Just take them at their word, at face value. Now, here's another thing I hate to answer, because it's a hard thing for me to say. I wish it wasn't true. I don't mind being wrong sometimes, and I wish this was one of them, but I'm not wrong. The Muslim Brotherhood is more saturated into our social political structure now than they were during the Obama administration. The only thing I can say is President Trump just hasn't got to the point where somebody stood in front of him and laid the evidence on the table. Because I have to believe if he actually knew it, I'm very confident if I had a half an hour with him, I could prove it to him. And I have a feeling he'd be infuriated. I do. I feel like I know him well enough. But if it actually got to him, if it was just at that right moment, over morning coffee, just when he was fully attentive and he really was able to focus on it and listen somebody tell him what's actually happening right inside of his own administration, he would be infuriated. But it's true, friend. They're in the DOD, the DHS, the FBI, DOJ, the State Department, the executive branch, the legislative branch, academia, right now, more deeply saturated than they ever were when I was active duty under the Obama administration. And yes, I can prove it. It's what I do for a living. I'm an intel officer. I'm still one. I still do cases. I just don't have an avenue to hand them off to. My only chain of command right now is Congress. And so, by the way, I'm intending to get back in the game again. I'm going to start a series of meetings with members of Congress starting this Friday, and then the following Monday, members of the Freedom Caucus. My intention my strategy, my goal, is to entree back into the Freedom Caucus and have them co-sign a letter and send it to the president and basically say, Mr. President, you need to talk to this guy. Stat. So I'm going to give it another shot between now and the election. I'm also writing a second book called National Security Meltdown, where I'm going to go into this in detail, even more detail than the last book, which was See Something, Say Nothing. So, yeah, I do honestly believe that President Trump really comprehended the extent of it, that he would take action. And I'd be there. I'd help him. I'd be glad to help him. But I won't do it unless I get an authorization and then backup from the president. Because for me to go right back in right now without backup, they'd put me in the meat grinder. I wouldn't last a day. I mean, literally, I would not last a day. Because I talk about stuff like this within a group of SES, senior executives, and top leadership of DHS. They'd file a grievance on me for Islamophobia before I was even halfway done with my briefing. They would. And they'd tie me up as a white supremacist and a racist Islamophobe. I wouldn't even get out of the building. I wouldn't. Because the same people that did everything I told you about already are still there. Not only are they still there, they're in higher levels of authority than they were when I was still active duty. They don't want me within 500 miles of that place. And they'll do whatever they can to stop me, just like they are doing with President Trump. 3 years of what I call an obscene charade to stop him. Violation of process, procedure, and policy. There's no due process. There's no hysteric policy. There's no constitutional procedure. They're doing it, making it up as they go along, just like they did with people like me. It's literally the same people. I don't mean sort of. I mean literally. Clapper, Brennan, Mueller, Johnson, Napolitano, Clinton, Obama, the DOJ, the DHS, it's all the same people. They're cops, by the way. They're not politicians. The people that are going after President Trump are not politicians, per se. They're not social workers. They're cops. That means that the law enforcement branch of the federal government is the most corrupt of all because they have those insulations of secrecy and non-accountability that allows them, if they want to abuse their position of authority, which is exactly what they've been doing. They're cops going after the president. Did you ever think about that?
I actually have, and the implication of what you are saying right now is essentially that our counterterror apparatus in America needs to be completely torn down and rebuilt. And that's astounding to me.
Well, if the proof of it, that's an overstatement. That can't be true. Really? Then why hasn't the Muslim Brotherhood been designated? That's your proof. The rest of it is just want, want, want. I don't care who you listen to from the administration or what branch of the government they're designating. Until we get to the representing, until we get to the point where they actually stand up in public at a press conference in some capacity and say, today we have taken steps to designate the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization. The rest of it is just want, want, want. That's it. That's the indicator. That's the litmus test. That's the canary in the coal mine. Until that day comes, you know they're not serious. They can't be. It's not possible. It's like taking an aspirin for a splinter. Just get a pair of tweezers and pull the splinter out. Don't take an aspirin. Take the splinter out. They haven't taken the splinter out. And that's your indicator, and that's for everybody listening. If you want to know whether the federal government is actually serious about counterterrorism, border protection, and national security, watch their behavior vis-a-vis the Muslim Brotherhood, and you'll know.
Phil, in the last few minutes that we have, first I'd like you to touch on Marxism. and the Marxists in America today. How big a threat really is that? I mean, in Washington State, we see Antifa on the streets burning stuff and rioting. We see the John Brown Gun Club, Redneck Revolt, and the Socialist Rifle Association trying to get purchase here in Washington State. If you could just comment on that here in a couple minutes.
Sure. There's a really easy way to get a handle on it. Let's just go back to the Declaration of Independence. And there's a sentence in there. It talks about the government becoming tyrannical. It says, when that happens, it's the right and duty of the people to alter or abolish the current form of government and replace it with one that's more suitable to them, to their goals. Well, what Antifa wants to do is that, alter or abolish the current form of government. And amazingly, so does Islam. They don't see the Constitution as our founding document. Antifa says that it's based on racism and slavery and white supremacy and so on. They want to alter or abolish the current form of government and replace it with one that's more suitable to their worldview. Ditto with Islam. No wonder they're such natural allies. They're both anarchists. They're both nihilists. They both want to destroy the current structure of our government and replace it with something. The problem with the progressive Antifa progressive socialists, I call them the apples, Antifa progressive leftist socialists, and is that they don't actually have a code of conduct. Everything with them is subjective. It changes from day to day to day. You ask them one day what they want to accomplish, they'll tell you one thing. Next week, it's different. Whereas with Islam, it's just the opposite. It's 100% objective. It's legal. It's actually a real book. It's called Sharia. So you have these two paradoxes allied together because they have the same goal in mind. They want to undermine and alter and abolish the current form of government. That's Antifa. That's leftism. That's the progressives. That's Bernie Sanders. That's Ocasio-Cortez or Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, all the candidates running for the Democratic side for president right now, the Congress, the Democrats, all of them. They all want to alter or abolish this racist, Islamophobic, bigoted, transphobic, et cetera, form of government and replace it one that is diverse and inclusive, but they can't tell you exactly what diversity or inclusivity actually means.
That's exactly right.
Can they?
It's really just a war against Western civilization. That's what it is. Phil, we're running out of time. If you could, where can people go to read more articles from you, watch some videos from you, and buy your book?
Mm-hmm. Well, Lantern of Liberty is a website. You can go on there. And I'm on Facebook. I'm Philip Haney that lives in Plymouth, California. There's two of them on there. So look for the one that says Plymouth, California. You can message me. If you can't find Lantern of Liberty website for some reason, just go on there and message me and I'll get you plugged in. And I'm going to be bringing up the National Security Meltdown website pretty soon. You can just query me if you want to see some of the stuff I've done. The book is out of print, but you can get it as Kindle. So I'm trying to remedy that too. I actually got the rights to my book back. So I actually own the rights to the book now. I'm going to look into self-publishing, get it back into circulation on Amazon. But you can get it, Kindle. And you look me up on Facebook or Lantern of Liberty website.
Phil, thank you for your courage. Thank you for your competence and for being willing to keep this fight up, even though they've tried to silence you and marginalize you. It's unbelievable, but this story needs to be told everywhere. People need to be educated. So thank you for joining me on Patriot Radio today, and make sure you keep up the fight.
Will do. Hope to talk to you again.
All right. That was Phil Haney, everybody, on Patriot Radio. Again, if you don't know who Phil Haney is, he was a founding member of the Department of Homeland Security, counterterrorism specialist, author of See Something, Say Nothing. He's coming out with a new book on national security meltdown about the infiltration into the United States government, really at all levels, of the Muslim Brotherhood. And also, I just think it's important to understand that this idea that everybody's kind of operating separately. The Shias are operating separately from the Sunnis. No, they're actually coordinated. The Intercept has the article and has the primary source documents that you can view right now, that you can view right now, that conclusively prove this. So this isn't just, you know, my speculation or something like that. It can conclusively prove that. And also, Rich Higgins' memo to President Donald Trump, where he outlines the Maoist insurgency model, and specifically the United Front, and this idea that the Squad is just a bunch of disgruntled folks. No, they're actually tied to the Marxists in America, and they're tied to the Muslim Brotherhood in America. And you need to understand that these two counter-states are working together. Specifically, this is their stated goal. Their stated goal to rewrite the Constitution of America, to transform this country. And for those of us that took an oath to protect and defend it, not only is that alarming, but it actually should be a motivation to action that we need to get involved. And the least thing that you can, this is the bottom basement level thing you can do, and that's vote. That's the bottom basement level. Next, you should be educating your friends and your family and your neighbors about what we just talked about on Patriot Radio, that this is real. Soleimani was not some sort of a peacemaker or something like that. He was a spy master. He coordinated and planned clandestine organizations and operations, not only in the Middle East, but throughout the world, that these guys are not just some organizations operating separately, but that they're actually operating together, the Muslim Brotherhood and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. It's important to understand this stuff, and that all the sole target, the biggest target, I should say, because there's also Israel being targeted, the biggest target is America. Remember that, and that's because we stand between freedom and liberty and tyranny and chaos. This is Matt Shea. Thank you once again for joining me on Patriot Radio. May God bless all of you, and may he make this generation truly, truly the greatest one.